Like the show? Want to listen to episodes early? Consider becoming a patron. Starting at the $3 a month level, patrons get access to a custom patron-only feed where we put out episodes of upstairs studio podcasts like the Childcare Bar and Grill, Miss Becky's Classroom, That Early Childhood Nerd, the Renegade Rules podcast, and others early. That feed is just for patrons. You could be one of them. Go to patreon.com/playvolutionhq or click the link in the show description to learn more. Childcare Bar and Grill Podcast. Jeff Johnson coming live from upstairs studio. In studio with me is Lisa Murphy.
Hello.
Josie Schneider.
Hello.
And via the magic of the interwebs, Heather Shoemaker is with us. Heather, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
I'm glad you're here. We got to turn up the volume a little bit, get things adjusted. Heather, co-host with me, the Renegade Rules podcast, where we talk about all things renegade and rulish. Josie, you tell us what we're talking about today, since you got the book sitting right in front of you.
We are talking about Heather's wonderful book for children called The Griffins of Castle Cary.
Even though it's spelled wrong.
It's spelled fine.
Lisa. My maiden name is Griffin, for those of you who don't know.
And Lisa really apparently wanted the book to be named after
her. I family. Really wanted it to be at Ian, but...
So next time I write a book, I have to clear the spelling of my main characters with you, Lisa.
Yeah.
Correct.
Please do. I have a private number you can call.
And if it's another one of this series, it needs to be a subplot where they change their name for some sort of reason.
So just to get this out of the way, the inspiration for this last name came from a street sign. There's this little alley in our town that is called Griffin Street. And that's where I got the name. So it was no intentional slightly.
Oh, I just like poking you.
So Josie, you read the book with Juliet, right?
Well, I will be honest. We are still in the middle of it. I was going to finish it with my daughter 6. I was going to finish it without her, but she panicked and said, "No, we have to read it together." She also was really upset when I took it with me. To come here instead, because she's enjoying it so much.
I think when you're done reading with her, you need to bring Juliet up here for a couple of weeks and let me read with her, because I enjoy hanging out with Juliet. She's good fun. So somebody jump in and let's talk about the book.
Well, I always appreciate books that are written for children that are also appreciated for various reasons by adults. And I wasn't surprised that how much I enjoyed it, but I really, really, really enjoyed it. And I read it while I was doing, of course, a lot of traveling, and often find myself sitting next to people who need book recommendations. And it clearly from the cover is obviously a book for children. And so people would ask, you know, why are you reading that? And oh, do you have kids? And so I very much suggested it to a lot of people along the way. I have given it to my sister. So I embarrassingly do not have my copy here with me. I shared it with her for the boys, my nephews, four nephews, two sets of twins. But my biggest compliment and feedback for Heather, and she knows this, but for our listeners, is that I really, 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 I don't want to overuse the word appreciated, but I will. I appreciated that she doesn't write down to children. I felt that the dialogue was not in any way, not dumbed down, but you used big words. You talked to them, not as though they were adults, but it was conversation that I could actually hear in my head. And I think a question directly as a writer, were you aware of that in your writing process? Like, was that a choice, or is that how you write for children?
Well, I was channeling my 10-year-old self, because as a 10-year-old and in those vicinity, you know, a couple years older, a couple years younger, this is the kind of book I adored as a kid. One that had a bunch of kids, whether they were siblings or friends or cousins, but a group of kids who have an adventure. And the adventure gets so exciting, you just can't put it down in the second half. And it's just page turning. And that's what I loved. Also having a sidekick of an animal. I enjoyed that as a kid, not a main character maybe, but the kids having a pet of some sort. So I inserted a giant drooly Newfoundland dog. And
which was so visually descriptive. Yes. I could see that dog through the whole book.
But as far as talking down to kids, in my own interactions, I don't put on sort of that fake adult or teacher voice that some people do. And so I can't do that in my writing either. It just would be abnormal. What I did have to do was when the book was finished and it was going up into editors and agents and other grown-up people were looking at it, I had to stand up for my book and say, no, kids can handle these topics. Some grown-ups thought it was too sad, or some people thought it was too spooky. But some of the kids, there was a 9-year-old boy who said, "This is just the right amount of spooky, and my favorite part." And you know, as there's a little, they find a bone, and that's one of the things. One of the more sensitive editors said, "Oh my gosh, kids can't take that." And I said, "Well, not all kids are going to like all kinds of books. You know, some kids want only horse books, or some kids want only realistic books. But for kids who like this kind of book, yes, they can take it. They have these emotions. And there's sorrow and death and grief in this book. But these are emotions that kids have to deal with, whatever their age, even if it's the grief over your ice cream cone spilled. I mean, the grief. And kids can cope with grief. So I also tried not to dumb down my vocabulary. I chose the words I felt were right for the story. And I had to stand up for that. And my final editor at Simon & Schuster did not blink an eye at the words I chose. She was fine with that. She had that same mindset. But along the way, people who were trying to help me get it published would say, "Oh, you use words that are too big for kids." And so one thing, when I go into schools and I talk to a whole room full of children, I hold up some words from the book and I say, "What's this word mean?" Like the word ovine, which a lot of their teachers don't know what this is. You know, it's not a word we toss around, but I say, "What's canine?" And all the kids say, "Oh, that's dog. What's feline?" And most of them know it's cat. And so then I read them the sentence or two where I use the word ovine in context, and they all say, "Oh, you know, that means sheep." So they pick it up because kids are much more used to new words than adults are. You get a little scared of a new word, whereas kids are learning new words all the time.
That's not a bad idea to help them learn vocabulary.
Well, I feel like that's really enhanced my reading experience with my daughter, because there's been a few times where she's paused me and said, "Hey, wait, what's that word?" And we've gone back to the sentence and we've talked about it. And just, you know, if you're doing a read aloud, that is just another level that instead of taking away from it, is really added to it. She's learned some great new vocabulary words as we go through the book together.
Well, I remember reading fiction when I was probably in that age range, and I was drawn to detective stuff and like World War II stuff, and vocabulary like that would pop up, and it would almost be like a mystery within the mystery I was reading, trying to figure out what it meant, and sometimes it was trying to figure out in context, and sometimes it meant I had to put the book down and go find the dictionary and just go back and forth to make sure I was looking it up right and get it spelled correctly and everything. And I think that's a valuable experience for kids in its own right, trying to figure that out if they've got that curiosity.
Yeah, you know, when I was writing it, back to your first question, Lisa, about, you know, was I trying to you know, not dumb it down purposely? I think my response is of what kids can handle. Mm-hmm. You know, kid and what they know. Kids aren't dumb; they just don't know things. And so there's a lot of things that kids haven't experienced or haven't learned yet. And they bring so much emotional, social, and other intelligence to whatever they encounter. And so if it's a new story, they're going to bring all that intelligence with them. They may not have encountered some either the words or the concepts in the story, but if they're interested in the characters and they want to know what's going to happen, they're going to learn it as they go. So no, I have the highest respect for young readers.
And you actually had some of them involved in that whole creation editing process, didn't you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I had, I involved children's librarians, parents, teachers, grandparents, and children themselves as test readers for the book. This is before it's published, when it's still a manuscript. And I asked kids around the country, pretty much from age 7 to 12, to read the book and give me feedback. I particularly wanted to know if it was interesting enough and if it was the right amount of spooky but not too scary, because my intent was to keep it suspenseful, but I'm not writing horror stories. I'm writing adventure stories. And yeah, I got that, that it was gripping and just the right amount of scary from the kids themselves. And no adult can tell you that. You know, you need to hear that straight from a child's heart.
Yeah.
It's very atmospheric. And it reminds me a lot of Mary Downing Hahn. I don't know if you're familiar with her as an author, but you know, she does tend to write horror novels for children. But the character she creates and the way she... Even though there is a ghost story that is kind of in the background, her characters are so engaging that children, kids love spooky things, and they're willing, even if it is maybe a little spooky, they're willing to jump in and follow these characters because the mystery, the characters are great, the mystery is engaging, and they want that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking as we were reading this, this is a perfect read aloud book for, I feel like, classroom teachers, because you end almost every chapter with a great cliffhanger. and there's just so many times I think about reading with my fifth graders. I was like, oh, this would be the perfect place to close the book and hear the screams of, no, keep reading just a little bit more. So you do a really great job.
Oh, thank you.
Readers in
If people have been listening, I'm a big proponent of sleep and that kids need a lot of sleep. Well, I've actually harmed some families, I believe. I've had several families who've been doing a read aloud with this book at home. And they say we had to stay up till 10 p.m., way past the kids' bedtime, several nights in a row in the second half of the book. So, yeah, I definitely have been damaging some bedtimes. Wow.
So
that's an awesome t-shirt idea. Yeah. Damager of bedtimes. Book so good.
And Lisa, what was it? You said something about you were finishing this book in the airport and you didn't miss your flight, so that's good, but can you share that story?
Oh, you're gonna have to jog my memory. Oh, that I sat in the gate, I think, to finish. I didn't go down to baggage claim, I think it was that I needed to finish the book, yes.
More than somebody walking off with your luggage.
Yes.
So you're working on an adaptation for stage or screen? Is there going to be a movie?
Oh, well, you know, I'm not working on that, no. I'm working on the next book, so you got
it. Are you able to tell us about it? I'm so excited about it.
Well, I have two next books, so I can tell you about them both. I do hope that The Griffins of Castle Cary will be a series, because I have a whole bunch of new adventures for the kids to fall into.
I hope it's going to be a series as well.
Yeah, so the same three kids. And as a kid, I loved being with the same group of kids again and again. And each time they had an amazing adventure. And you know what kind of book to expect, and you want to see what's going to happen this time. So the next book is called The Griffins and the Wild Hunt. And it's the same kids, they go back to England. The books are set in England, at least the first two are set in England. And The Wild Hunt is this ancient European legend where on Midsummer's Eve, particularly, a hunt of wild hunts dogs and huntsmen on horses race across the sky. So they're kind of a ghost hunt racing across the sky. And legend is if you get caught up in the hunt, you're never seen again, you know.
Oh.
So, and because of all the dogs part of the Wild Hunt, I have the dog in the story jump into the hunt and one of the kids jumps after him. And that's part of the story. And then the other two kids have an adventure with in an ancient hill fort, a ghost from 2,000 years ago. So, Will, how do you get them out of the hunt and what's going to happen? I haven't figured it all out, but that's part of the fun of writing a book.
But Henry, you said they're never to be seen again, and did we lose them? Are they going to come back?
Well, you'll have to, you know, that'd probably be on chapter 18 or something. I'll explain all that.
Oh man.
But kids are asking for a sequel. And I got a very nice high compliment from a 10-year-old the other day. She said, I'm rereading the book.
I'm rereading.
Yes.
And you think back of all the books, you know, that you reread. There's books that you liked, and then there's books that you reread.
That's awesome. So what's the other one you're working on?
Well, the other one's about pirates.
Yes, that's what I want to hear more
now,
about.
Now, is this fiction or is this real?
Yes, it's both.
Okay.
It's historical fiction, but it's an adventure. It's women pirates, and the two famous women pirates that I'm focusing on are Anne Bonny and Mary Read, and they were pirating in 1718, so 300 years ago.
Oh, sweet.
And so, I'm on chapter 23. We're just about to have a duel. We're going to go to an island and fight it out. In some ways I say it's Katniss from the Hunger Games meets the pirates. Because it's a pirate story, but it's very strong women characters. They're teenage girls, but I think kids from 10 and older will be fascinated by this book.
Wonderful.
That's great. So process-wise, Heather, writing the fiction compared to doing It's Okay Not to Share and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, is that process different or is it just for you, is it like going to work? You get up in the morning, you get to the keyboard and you start pumping out words.
Oh, this is so much more fun. Fiction is much more fun, but it's also the hardest work I've ever done. It's incredibly hard, at least for me. Nonfiction, I feel, as long as I have some ideas and I can explain them clearly, that's not a problem. Fiction, you have to do so much more. And as I say, I have extremely high regard for young readers. If you think about how little time kids have to read all the good books in the world that are worth their time between, say, the ages of 6 and 12, how do they squeeze all the fantastic books into that span of time? And so every book they read has to be worth it. So I endeavor to write a book that's worth their time.
That's great, especially with so many things competing for that very small amount of time. Josie, what are your thoughts on this whole thing and kids and reading and literature, just that whole general topic of getting kids to actually sit down with print and put it in their head? That's kind of your job, isn't it?
It is kind of my job. Well, I mean, I think Heather said it nicely. If it's worth their time,
they'll make the time.
They will make the time to do it. Not every child is going to be a bookworm who wants to spend all of their free time reading, but I have never met a child who hates the idea of reading so much that they won't sit and listen to a story. So I think even if it's not something they're choosing to do on their own, if you can make this a family activity, you know, you find these really great, and it doesn't have to be fiction. I mean, there's a lot of really great nonfiction for kids too, but it tends to be fiction. You find these really great fiction books and you sit down and you make this a fun family time, they're going to have a lot of positive associations from listening to a story, which then may encourage them to pick up a book on their own later. I think you just have to also have a wide variety of books because not every child's going to love the same thing. I mean, I feel there are universal themes, mystery, adventure. Most children are going to sit and enjoy a story along those lines, but just really pay attention to what your kids are interested in and try to help them find some reading material that brings elements of that into the story.
I made a mental note about this while we were talking. I think of the three of you, two or all of you mentioned the idea that kids like to be scared and like to play around with that. And I thought maybe before we wrapped up, we could unpack that a little bit. Where's that come from? The book is a safe haven for exploring those things, or what?
I think so. I can project my fear onto the character and then see it come to resolution in the pages or while somebody is talking to me. And even if I can't express that, perhaps verbally my own self, I still will I still have the opportunity to identify with a feeling that might be too big for me to verbalize myself.
Mm-hmm. And it's exciting. You can have a character do something that you would never do. Some of my favorite books, I would never be that character, but I admire them so much. And I think, wow, you know, but I could never be any of the characters in Harry Potter, much too scary for me, but I love reading about it. So kids have that same reaction. And some of them won't want to read a book that has anything scary at all in it. And that's okay too. There's plenty of books that don't have that. But one of the things that I've had comments about the Griffins book is that it's got this kind of flavor to it that's a bit of old-fashioned charm. Mm. It's not a heavy-duty, scary book. It has suspense in it, but it's not too much for kids. But it's also, it doesn't go easy on some of their, that when you get near the end, they're definitely drawn into it. So it's got a light-hearted tone, which I think makes it much more friendly and approachable. And the kids tell me that they can get through the scary parts because they have the dog in the story. And the dog is big and huge and huggable. He's not there at all times because as an author, here's one of the challenges, is you have to get rid of the protectors. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise the kids can't solve their own problem at the climax. So if you think about all the children's books in the world that you've read, you have to get rid of the parents. Mm-hmm. You have to get rid of the parents. Mm-hmm. Because they hover and they protect and they do things like call 911. And that would just ruin the story.
Ruins the whole story.
Ruins the story if mom comes in with a cell phone and calls 911. And okay, so you have to get rid of the parents and then you have to get rid of cell phones and other useful technology. So if you read kids' books that are set in modern times, there are so many cell phones, the batteries run out, the phone is dropped, the phone falls in the ocean, the phone is dropped off a train. They get rid of these cell phones constantly because otherwise you have to set it back in time or you have to travel into another world to get rid of them.
I was listening to a podcast the other day. They were talking exactly about this, that the cell phone is plot point, and that's why so many movies and television shows right now are coming out in set in the recent past.
Right,
the 80s and early 90s, because that technology wasn't there.
So I got rid of, I had the parents go off to a conference and they have to go stay with their aunt. So, you know, aunts are very nice people. Aunts and uncles, they love the kids, but they're not quite the same as parents, especially aunts that don't have kids themselves. They're a little less protective. So they're with this nice eccentric aunt who loves them, but isn't going to hover as much. So that's one thing. But then I had the dog who's kind of a protector. And I had to send him to the vet, and you know, send him off because you got to get rid of him at certain places. Otherwise, the kids can't solve their own problems. And that's one thing that's so satisfying to a child reader is when the kids themselves learn and grow and figure out how to solve the problem. In this case, of a ghost problem of the book.
Any more questions, guys?
My nerd brain is now. I had never ever, and I'm not a writer. I am a writer, but I don't lead with that as an identifier for my own self. I have never ever ever stopped, not even to consider it. There's no way I would have ever considered that as something you had to do as the writing process of getting. So in my brain, I'm wondering if that fits in with the whole hero's journey cycle that most books fit
in your beloved fairy tales.
Yeah, it's like at what point it has that protector element intentionally been removed so that the children or whatever the other characters are can bring it to resolution their own self. I'm floored. I've had two major bones today, and Heather, you provided the second one, so thank you.
So now every book that you read, it's so fun to see when they get rid of the parents. I was reading one.
You're not going to not ever be able to see that. You are not going to be able to unsee that.
I know. So there's one book, the Gregor and the Overlander series.
Yes.
You can give the mother the plague. You know, it's like the bubonic plague. They get to the plague to get rid of her. They resort to very drastic ways of getting rid of parents. The book I just started with my son this week, they sent the father off, you know, for work. There's a war going on. He's a war correspondent. So he goes to the other end of the world. And then the mom, it's set back in time. She's ill, so she has to go to southern France to recover, you know. So they got rid of both parents in one paragraph. And I said, did you see what they just did? They got rid of the parents so the kids can have an adventure.
That's awesome.
I just thought for future listeners out there, Okay, so we know podcasts get listened to in different times and places, and so this episode is going to get listened to in the future by somebody. And at some point in the future, somebody's going to be listening to this episode, and Lisa or Heather is going to have three or four more of these in the series books out. And I would like to hear somebody go through those fiction books in the future, because a couple of them haven't been written yet, and look for Heather's renegade rules in the fiction book she's creating, and do some sort of report or thesis on that.
So Heather, I'm going to ask you a question, pretending like Jeff's not here. Have you done that? Are you aware of that?
Well, as the book's been finished, I realize more and more how my ideas of renegade rules are in this book. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of them is just the kids' independence, right? Yeah. Taking risks and independence, and that's one reason why I set the book in England, because kids wandering around, walking by themselves, investigating things, you couldn't really do that in modern America without people calling the police.
And mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's easier. Kids still walk to school. They take the subway by themselves. They take trains by themselves. So it was easier for them to adventure in that country. So I have things like risk and independence. I have a lot of stuff about grief and feelings that are unresolved, because this whole book came out of a longing and a grief that I had. It came from a miscarriage. I lost a child, and I was grieving so deeply. I was out cross country skiing, and the whole idea for this book came to me. Hmm. As I was skiing, I thought my grief for this lost child was so large that it would outlive me. And that I said, oh my gosh, that's what a ghost must be. It must be someone mm-hmm. whose feelings are so big that never got resolved, and they're going to swirl around the world forever. And that's when the whole idea for the three kids and the dog and the well scene and all the ghosts came into my mind. And by the end of that ski, I had the whole book in my head.
Wow.
It started with this grief. And so there's an element of grief that goes through the book. And I think the idea that feelings are so important, and that unresolved feelings can really trip you up, even if you're a ghost, that comes through the renegade rules. So yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of merging between the fiction book, which is just a simple children's story, and the renegade books.
But after it'd be a good report to it's somebody should do.
Awesome.
That's somebody's thesis at some point in the future. So you're welcome, listener, who I suggested to, who actually goes out and does it.
For extra credit. And
yeah, send me a copy. Any more before we wrap this one up?
Yeah, I've got two more quick things.
Okay, good.
Talking about feelings, you were making me think of the three siblings' relationships, and just, oh, how spot on you are, because they all love each other, and yet they feel normal, you know, not always pleasant feelings towards each other. I'm thinking about the youngest, who, you know, is significantly younger than the older two who are close together, and how she does feel like she's always left out by them. I think about the middle child, who is frustrated by the younger sister, because, you know, things always get ruined because she's slower. She can't keep up with the group. I just thought you captured that really well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some kids who've been reading aloud with their parents, and the mom came to me and said, we had a great discussion about sibling relationships at the end of the book, because there's some stuff about how we don't necessarily see each other even when we live with each other every day, and because some of the kids can see the ghosts and some can't. So there's a whole discussion about how he said, you know, that's like me and my brother. He doesn't always see me. And so there's a lot of sibling relationship. And I think that has to do with, well, they're real people. You know, these aren't just, okay, they're fictional. They're real fictional people. And they don't fight in this book. You know, I get tired of reading children's books where the siblings are always at each other's throat. So it's a loving, caring family that doesn't get on all the time, which is mm-hmm. much more how a loving, caring family interacts, a healthy family. Yeah. Thank you.
I was really impressed with how you interweave history throughout the book. Things about, I mean, a book about England, things about the Roman Empire, and, you know, like artifacts that they find. What is your research process?
Yes, well, it's extensive. I love history. I was almost a history major. And I feel kind of like these fictional kids do, that when you go to a country that has really old buildings, you know, you can see Roman ruins from thousands of years ago. It puts you in a different frame of mind if you walk by that every day on your way to school than if you're walking in a different landscape. But even though our natural world is just as old the whole planet over, the humans sometimes notice it more when it's a crumbling castle, or whether mm-hmm. it's part of an old Roman wall or something like that. A lot of this, since I love history and I soak it up everywhere I go, I have the basics in my head and then I go back and verify facts. Mm-hmm. So for this book, a lot of my research wasn't that kind of historical research, but it was things like, how much does a Newfoundland dog drool? Which turns out it's a lot. I checked in. So this is part of my research process. I asked an owner of a Newfoundland dog to read the book ahead of time and make sure that it was accurate. And because I didn't want someone who reads the book and owns a Newfie to think that's not what life is like with a Newfie.
I had
to
add that
gruel, you know, into the book. But I also asked people who live in England to read the book ahead of time. I went to school in England as a child. I lived there for a year. I have a lot of British relatives. My great-grandmother lived in Somerset, which is where this book is set. So I set it in a fictional town, but in an area that I was familiar with. And with all my British connections, I thought, okay, I've got this vocabulary down. I know what I'm doing. I've got all this down. And I sent it to three British readers, expecting to find maybe two or three mistakes that I had missed.
Oh, how many, Heather?
135 mistakes.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Even things like how I described the ambulance, you know, I had pictured, there's an ambulance scene, and it's a white, you know, in my mind, it was a white clunky ambulance with red flashing lights, and it reflects on the aunt's hair, the red lights. And then I did a little more research. Oh, no. Of course not. That's what American ambulances look like. The British ambulance in that part of the country is neon yellow with green checkerboards and blue flashing lights.
Hmm.
So you just got to get all the little details right.
Yeah, because you don't want to deal with the emails later when people are complaining.
No.
I wonder, though, if that attention to that level of detail, if you think about comparing existing books, future books, not yours, ever, all the books, if that is one of the things that kind of raises one of the books up above other books. I don't know what I'm saying, but just the, like, super, like, a lot of people wouldn't care about how much the dog really drools, but I think that caringness, whether it's stated or not, I think that probably comes through in a reader resonates with that or connects with that or is appreciative of it, because you're not questioning anything. You don't have any barriers getting in the way of you being able to jump in and experience the story.
Right. And when you're writing fiction, you don't realize how much you don't know. There's a doll in the story, and I don't know much about antique dolls, but one of my readers said, well, that's very valuable. You know, what about the dolls, Mark? What about this? And they didn't even have China dolls during that time period. I had to change a lot of things.
Huh.
I had someone who knows about horses read it, because there's a bridle that they find, and it was all wrong. And so you have to just, there's so many people who have deeper knowledge in a certain area than you do. And you wouldn't even believe how much research I did on sheep sex.
And that'll be a book on its own.
The child readers won't even notice. But as a kid, when I was walking in there's a lot of right-of-ways where you can walk through the pastures, and there's a lot of sheep, and you have to step around the droppings. And so I had some of the same countryside in this story with the sheep. But what I remember being about the youngest character's age, Ariel is about 5 or 6 in this book, is that a lot of the sheep had markings on their wool. You know, they were red, looked like red blood, or it was green, or it looked like the sheep had been painted. Mm-hmm. And that really struck me as a child. I might have missed all kinds of, you know, oh, look at this historic church, but I was noticing that the sheep were painted. So I wanted to incorporate that into the story, and I ended up having to talk to someone who was neighbors with a sheep farmer, because I had all, they've changed things since I wandered the fields, and things like, used to be they were painting the sheep because they were keeping track of whose sheep was whose when they mixed in the fields. Well, they told me, well, you know, nowadays we have hoof and mouth disease. We don't let the stock intermingle in the fields. So we use electronic ear tags instead. And I had to learn a lot more about sheep and their habits and current farming practices than I ever expected for this book.
Now if they've got paint on it, it's just graffiti artists just going, right. going and tagging them. Tag the sheep. That happens, right? Miscreants in the countryside? I think it happens.
Probably.
Yeah, okay. I'll shut up. Any other questions? Go ahead, Heather.
I think, again, it's my level of respect for the young readers. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to present them a good book, and even though it's made up, even though it's fiction, it's set in the real world and the magical world, and I want it to be as accurate as possible and believable, because if there's something that doesn't strike you as right, it's the same thing if a child listens to an adult say something in that kind of voice, they know not to trust you. Mm-hmm. So I want them to fall into the story and just live in the story and not worry about my job is to worry about the details.
Nice. You know, if you're looking for yet another good thing to say about Heather Shoemaker, it says that she cares about how much dog drool there is.
I added it to the list.
Yeah, make sure that agrees. Okay, the list of
why Heather is awesome.
There's a list we keep, an ongoing list for some projects we're working on. Why Heather should make those awesome. Hey, Josie, Lisa, any other questions for Heather before we wrap up?
Well, I want to ask if there's another Renegade Rules book coming.
Oh, well, I'm having so much fun with fiction. You might have to wait a couple decades on that.
Okay. Fair enough.
I don't want to close the door, but the door's going to be open for a long time. Hey, you can find Heather Shoemaker at heathershoemaker.com. You can find the book where, Heather?
Well, it's in all bookstores. So it's published by Simon & Schuster. You can find it in regular bookstores. You can find it in online bookstores. And what's even more exciting is I would love to come visit your school. I mean, elementary schools or middle schools. I've visited both sort of grades, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, even some eighth graders. So if you're thinking that you would like a good read aloud book or just invite an author into school, I have so much fun. With the kids and teaching them about writing and my excitement about books. And as you can tell, I can go on and on about this, but for the assemblies, I stick to 45 minutes. That's the time that we have.
I was able to order an autographed copy for grandbaby Rowan because ordered it from a bookstore in Heather's community. And she just kind of went over there and signed it before they shipped it to me.
Wow, so, that was nice.
I know she's done that for people too. That's a delightful way to get kind of a personalized copy. This has been the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. We will be back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
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 There we go. Thank you, Heather.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.